Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're going to talk about a hidden, long-term consequence of domestic violence. As such, we will be hearing stories from survivors. So a warning to listeners, some of these stories contain explicit details of physical abuse. Freya Doe shared her story with us and the abuse she suffered from the very beginning of her first marriage when she was just 18 years old.
In the very beginning, I thought I was happy. I thought I was getting the things that I wanted and needed emotionally. Looking back, I wasn't happy. I was always in emotional turmoil, to be quite honest. There was a lot of tears. There was a lot of crying. But he was very good at convincing me that I was happy and that he was the one for me. And again, it wasn't until I was much older that I looked back and realized that, yeah, I was not content. And what was happening was not love. It was obsession, it was manipulation, and in a lot of ways it was torture. I was not allowed to leave the house. I had one friend that was his friend's wife who I was allowed to hang out with. I wasn't allowed to get a job. And as time progressed, he got more and more frustrated with things at work. And he was in the military, so he couldn't get upset with his sergeant. So he would bring that anger home with him and lash out at me. Anywhere from walking in the door and flinging his keys at my head to grabbing me and slamming my head against the wall. If I said, you know, how was your day, I might get punched. It was a constant situation of not necessarily knowing who was going to walk through that door. If he had a good day, things would be okay. If he had a bad day, anything goes. There was a day when he had been drinking in the morning and I had gone out and done laundry and I brought it home, and he was upset about something that someone had said to him and got into a fight with me and punched me in the face first and then picked me up and threw me off a porch, then proceeded to jump on top of me and repeatedly slam my head into the ground and punch me in the face. Eventually, I woke up on the floor, and then he just stopped dead and looked at me and said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Your eyes." And he stood me up, and I went over to the dresser, and I looked, and the blood vessels in my eyes were starting to burst. That convinced him to allow me to call 911, but he kept saying, "I don't want to get in trouble, I don't want to get in trouble. If you call 911, they'll find out what I did." And I said, "Listen, I will just tell them that I fell off the porch, that I was dizzy and slammed the door into my face, and it'll be okay, just let me call them. I need to go to the hospital." And they came. They got me on the backboard. They put the neck brace on. They got me in the stretcher. I'm completely tied down. And the guy in the ambulance gets in, and he's sitting next to me. And my husband is standing on the end of the ambulance looking down at me as this guy says, "Did your husband do this to you?" And I just, you know, shook my head as much as I could, which was not much. And I was like, no, of course not. He would never do something like that to me. He loves me. He would never hurt me. They did 22 x-rays of my head, neck, back, and chest. And I was in the hospital for 5 days. A neurologist came in to see me. He said, "Well, looks like, you know, you've got a concussion." And he said, "You know, you're probably going to have some light sensitivity for a while, and you'll have some migraines maybe, but, you know, the blood will drain out of your eyes and you'll go, you know, everything will go back to normal." I just thought, okay, well, you know, by the time the blood drains out of my eyes, the migraine should probably go away and light sensitivity will probably go away. And the funny thing is that neither has ever gone away. And it wasn't until about 15 years later that I started having some cognitive issues where I would be talking to somebody and all of a sudden in the middle of conversation, I would just kind of stop dead. My eyes would look around because I could not for the life of me remember what it was that I was talking about. I could be in mid-sentence and just all of a sudden it's gone. Everything I was thinking is just out of my head. I started thinking that I was getting early onset Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia or something to that effect. I chose at that point in time from fear to basically ignore that and just put it out of my head, telling myself it's just something that happens to people. And then I started forgetting words. Like, I knew what I wanted to say and I could describe what I wanted to say, but the actual word that I wanted to use, I could not find. And every time that I would forget a word, or I'd forget what I was talking about, or I wouldn't remember somebody's name that I had known for forever, that stress would, like, spike. And I had also developed a lot of anxiety. I started having panic attacks and things like that. That's how stressed this whole thing had gotten me. It didn't really dawn on me that I was still having these symptoms from that particular event. Never went through my mind.
Freya Doe. Freya is a pseudonym. We are not disclosing her name or location in order to protect her safety. There is much more to her story, which we will hear later in the show. As you heard Freya describe, though, she was clearly suffering from repeated traumatic brain injury due to the violence she suffered by the hand of her first husband. Well, Eve Valera joins us now. She's an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and a neuroscientist who spent more than 20 years researching the prevalence of traumatic brain injury resulting from, intimate partner violence. Professor Valera, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. So nice to be here, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to talk about this issue.
Can I just first ask you, can you briefly describe to us how many women survivors out there may there be in the United States like Freya?
Well, in my work, if you want to extrapolate from that, in the study I found that about 74% women sustained at least one traumatic brain injury from the partner, and just over 50% sustained repetitive brain injuries from their partners. And so to put that in perspective, that could be potentially, if this is extrapolating from my data, which is not epidemiological, but nonetheless an extrapolation, over 31 million women might be walking around with brain injuries from their partners. And 24 million women, and this is in the U.S. alone, walking around with repetitive brain injuries from their partners. If we want to compare that to sports, so you say, what does that really mean? Or other situations in which we know that there's, or recognize, let's just say, that there's brain injuries. Annual estimates for like servicemen and women might be around 18,000. And for the National Football League of the United States, that would be around 300 or 400 a year. Annual estimates for women could be as high as 1.6 million. Hmm. So from my, estimates, and again, these could be high because we don't have great epidemiological data, but even if you were to slash that considerably, there's really no comparison in terms of the number of women who I think have repetitive brain injuries and the number of men largely who are being studied in athletics or the military.
Yeah. Can you tell us the story of where you were when you first started trying to put two and two together about TBI and survivors of domestic violence?
Absolutely. I was actually in graduate school and I was doing volunteer work in a women's shelter. That was part of my interest. And I was also learning about neuropsychology, which looks at the effects of things like brain injuries in people, right? And so as I'm doing the work in the shelter, I hear these stories about, you know, and I thank Freya so much for sharing her story. It's so powerful and sad, but very powerful. And yes, I would hear stories about women having their heads slammed against floors and walls, being thrown downstairs, having their heads smashed against the car window. And I said, my gosh, these women are certainly sustaining brain injuries. And from what I was learning in my graduate work, it was clear that brain injuries are related to cognitive functioning, emotional functioning, behavioral problems like headaches, et cetera. And the women at the shelter were also reporting symptoms like that. So I looked and I said, okay, what do we know about this? This is crazy. We have to figure this out. And I do a lit search. I go to the library. There wasn't a single article, absolutely nothing. And this was in the 90s. There was not one article that came up when I tried to find that, no matter what type of search words I used.
Nothing.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, Professor Valera, stand by here for just a second, because we're headed into the break now and want to talk a lot more about what has happened in the 20 years since, or more than 20 years, since you first decided to start looking into this. And we'll hear from another a woman who's done a great deal of research on this. And folks, if you're out there and this is something that may ring true to you, hop on social media on Facebook or Twitter and let us know what you think about this idea of a hidden epidemic of traumatic brain injury in survivors of domestic violence. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about what could be considered a hidden epidemic of traumatic brain injury amongst survivors of domestic violence. Potentially tens of millions of people in this country suffering traumatic brain injury due to violence they received by the hands of their intimate partners. I'm joined today by Eve Valera. She's a neuroscientist who spent more than 20 years researching TBI and intimate partner violence. She's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and a research scientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and she joins us from Quincy, Massachusetts. And I'd like to now bring in Rachel Ramirez into the conversation. She's with us from Columbus, Ohio, and she's a licensed social worker and founder director of the Center on Partner-Inflicted Brain Injury. It's a project run by the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. Rachel Ramirez, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been waiting to talk about this with an audience like yours for a long time, so we really appreciate you bringing the importance and attention to this issue that it deserves.
So can you tell us more about, you've done surveys, Rachel, right, amongst survivors and healthcare providers about what they know regarding the possibility of head trauma and TBI and domestic violence. What have you found about how much is known?
Well, just to give you a little bit of background, I work for the Statewide Coalition on Domestic Violence. We have 75 local domestic violence programs that provide services to over 100,000 individuals in Ohio. And one of the role of our work at the coalition, of which I've been at for 15 years, is really preparing domestic violence programs to provide the best services possible to survivors who are experiencing abuse. We were given a grant in 2016 to look at increasing access to domestic violence services. And I got very, very lucky that we had written in the Ohio State University as an evaluation partner on that grant. After the grant was awarded, I sat down with Dr. Juliana Nemeth at the College of Public Health at Ohio State, and it became very clear that we had so much more that we needed to learn about this issue that we wanted to take a research route into this. So we went and we talked to five local domestic violence programs, members of ours, and also talked to survivors who were accessing those services in 2017. When we talked to survivors and we asked, have you been hit in the head, hit or hurt in the head? 86% of survivors said yes, with half of survivors saying, I couldn't even tell you how many times I've been hit or hurt in the head. And 83% of survivors had been choked or strangled, which is another cause of brain injury, with about a fifth of them saying that they had been choked or strangled too many times to count, and over 70% saying that they had been strangled a few times, at least a few times.
And can I just jump in here for a quick second?
Please.
So did they... Not that I expect someone who's going through that kind of abuse and trauma to to think about these things, but when you ask them later on in that 2017 survey, did they say that they had, if they had ever wondered if they had suffered some kind of brain injury from that abuse then?
Hardly anybody said that. And one of the very, very, all of these interviews were done in person, on site, face-to-face interviews. And I think even through the conversation of having it with survivors, even though survivors had this extensive history of head trauma, they had never thought about it in the context of a concussion, never thought about it in context of a brain injury, and that being the source of some of their challenges and some of their struggles.
And then what about the healthcare providers that you talked to as well?
And again, the service providers that we talked to were mostly individuals who were working with domestic violence programs. Mm-hmm. And we asked them questions about, how much do you know about brain injury? Have you ever learned anything about brain injury? What have been your experiences working with survivors with brain injuries? And it was amazing how it was almost like a blank stare that we got back from many domestic violence service providers. And it was just kind of like this, huh. But then even a few minutes into the group or 15 minutes, 30 minutes later, people would say, well, I remember this survivor who had told me about head trauma and was having this and this challenge and struggle. Maybe that was a brain injury. Or I remember this survivor who had struggles after experiencing strangulation, and maybe that was a brain injury. It was a framework that was really just being introduced to everybody, but it was something that everyone was like, oh my gosh, this makes so much sense.
Okay, so hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn back to Eve Valera. Professor Valera, you told us a few minutes ago that you had first started thinking about this in the late 90s, and you know, Rachel's been working on this for a long time too, but Rachel just said that this survey that she's talking about was done in 2017. Now, well before 2017, we as a nation were talking about head injuries, traumatic brain injuries from, you know, in athletes, right? We had football players sitting there telling us about how their lives were transformed by all the hits they took to the head, even with their helmets. Military, as you had mentioned earlier, with concussions and head injuries from war. And yet, it's shocking to hear that it seemed like such a light bulb moment, or an oh, as Rachel said, that when asked amongst violence survivors, two and two hadn't been put together even by 2017.
Exactly.
I mean, I didn't really have a question there. It's just like, so let me ask the question. How is it possible that it went so long, even as you and Rachel and others have been trying to expand awareness about this?
I will say that there's no good reason for it. Honestly, there's no good reason. But I mean, there's a lot of potential reasons we could hypothesize about. I mean, in truth, it's a male-dominated society, and men get studied more than women if we're going to talk about understanding brain injuries, for example. In research, we know that men are overwhelmingly studied, whether you're males, whether you're studying humans or animals. NIH had to actually put out an initiative to say, hey, we have to study more females. This has to be more of an even thing. And NIH is the National Institutes of Health, which provides a lot of grant funding. And so it was recognized that females weren't even really being studied the way they should. So most of what we know about brain injury is based on men. And what happens, I think, is we end up learning or studying or focusing on things that are quote unquote, important to us or important to society. And what's important to society? Well, of course, you know, the men and women who serve in the military are important to society. And that's absolutely true, right? I mean, we value those people. And also, well, for a lot of people, football is important to society. I mean, of course, these we watch these people on prime time, you know, smash themselves, you know, repeatedly in a game of football every Sunday or Thursday or Monday, whatever. And the NFL, the National Football League, is a huge industry. So, of course, that's important. So when something comes out in one of those arenas that says this is really important and these people may be sustaining brain injuries, then people pay attention. But when a paper gets written on arguably a marginalized section of the population, because people say, oh, those are just, you know, women who experience partner violence. Those are just kind of those women over there. We don't, they're not that important. Well, they could just leave if they want to, or that's a private family matter. And then it's very stigmatizing too. So we don't want to talk about it in that regard. Yeah. So basically, we know gender-based violence it disproportionately affects women, Native Americans, LGBTQ communities, and underserved communities. So it's, in my opinion, it's largely driven by the fact that this just isn't deemed as important. So there haven't been the resources to study it.
As far as I understand, you may be the only NIH-funded researcher on this.
Or I was the first.
You
I was
were the first. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, and let's just put it this way: for an NIH, I was able to secure a small grant back in a training grant back in graduate school. But this is, to the best of my knowledge and my program officer's knowledge, the first NIH-funded grant to use basically neuroimaging to study brain injury. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of such grants or thousands studying others with respect to brain injury.
So, Rachel, let me turn back to you. And before I fully do, I'll just throw this in. If there's anyone from the NFL listening who wants to use their gigantic megaphone to draw attention to the hidden epidemic of domestic violence survivors also suffering from traumatic brain injury, please do. You know, in thinking about the comparison of the trauma that athletes or soldiers go through, they now have protocols, though, right? Like every time you get hit in the head or experience some kind of potentially concussive events, you get sidelined and examined, or you get taken off active duty, et cetera. There are protocols in place. But for survivors of domestic violence, A, they may never get medical care in the wake of the latest attack on them. And B, if they do, I'm not sure there are any protocols in place right now to ask about traumatic brain injury. And C, there's no sideline for them. They have to go, they have to continue on in their lives, right, in the circumstances which led to the injury in the first place.
Yeah, it's a lot, isn't it? You know, I think that was something that was so interesting as one of the really important collaboration we've tried to do is help bring people who do brain injury work and people who do domestic violence work together to talk about this issue. But they're fields that have operated in very, very separate orbits and very, very separate spheres. And when you see, when we think even about some of the identification protocols we have for veterans and athletes, a lot of those depend on bystanders or training parents, training coaches, training teachers to recognize signs. There aren't any bystanders in domestic violence. There are very few individuals who are assaulted in the head or choked or strangled in front of somebody. So there's nobody to stop the clock, nobody to check and make sure that you're doing okay. I mean, we just heard Freya's story about her journey just to even get someone to look at her. And then you see protocols that say things like avoid stress. And it's just totally unrealistic for the situation of domestic violence survivors, which is why talking about this in forums and in places like this is so important, because we can't, there's no kind of external group of people that we can train that can go in and, you know, kind of be there watching and alert for a possible brain injury.
So can you both talk for a minute in it, just so that people, again, to raise this awareness, in an ideal situation, in which none of these situations are, but when someone suffers from a brain injury, like, what are the treatments that they, in order to recover from it? I mean, reduction of mental load, things like that. I mean, what is that supposed to look like? Eve, let me turn to you on that first.
Yes, you're exactly right. We don't have, you know, at least yet, we don't have some gold standard medicine or anything like that we can give people when they have a brain injury. So it's not something as simple as that. But just as we've seen in terms of what happens, say, for example, in athletics, you hit the nail on the head. There's a reduction of mental load, of physical load, et cetera. And there's a knowledge that you've sustained this brain injury. And if you keep pushing yourself, and if you currently have what we call post-concussive symptoms, so symptoms that may occur after a brain injury, which may include headache, dizziness, fatigue, depression, et cetera. If you have those symptoms and you keep pushing yourself, you're much less likely to recover from them. It's going to take longer to recover than if you dial everything back and then gradually resume your regular activities once you feel like you can and you don't have those symptoms return. And avoiding stressors like the bright light or the loud noises and things like that. So that is basically the protocol for people who have brain injuries. And another really important factor is avoiding sustaining another brain injury, period, but especially before that previous brain injury has had time to recover. Mm. So for the women who are experiencing partner violence, they may easily, and we know that many of them are sustaining brain injuries, one brain injury, they're still probably suffering from that one, still have symptoms, and then they sustain another one. And maybe it would be in the form of you know, getting their head hit against something. And we don't even know what the interaction is between something like a traumatic brain injury where their head is physically forced to smash against something or strangulation that may cut off oxygen to the brain and cause potentially hypoxic damage to the brain. And that's another form of what we might say an acquired brain injury. So there's so many unknowns, and that's just another reason why women in partner violence situations need to be studied. Because, you know, if you look at other brain injured populations, even repetitive brain injuries, say, for example, maybe in the military or in sports, they're getting a certain type of brain injury. But most of those people, so I think that's really important.
Yeah, so your connection there just got a little shaky, but I think you were saying that in terms of athletics, it's, or football in particular, we understand the type of brain injuries better than we understand, far, far, far better than we understand the type of brain injuries that survivors of domestic violence have, because we don't have enough research about what's happening in people's homes. But Rachel, let me turn back to you. So again, before we talk about, we're going to talk about in the show, like, how do we improve this situation? But I want to better understand the status quo at the moment. How hard is it for survivors to get assistance or services at the moment?
Well, and I think that is one of our challenges, as we have set up a service system that, again, was constructed in the 1980s and 1990s, and when we had a lot less knowledge about domestic violence, a lot less knowledge about brain injury, and a lot less knowledge about the intersection. So brain injury and its impact wasn't even really taken into consideration when we were designing these services and these systems, thinking about the complicated paperwork that sometimes domestic violence victims might need to do if they want to get a protection order, talking about the importance of their story or being able to remember details of events when somebody might be involved in a criminal prosecution. You know, kind of my world and my responsibility at the statewide coalition is really looking at domestic violence programs. And it was even getting to the point where we were like, oh my gosh, you know, we have these people come in into shelter services, and then we have this big packet of intake paperwork. And, you know, we've often, you know, we have certain, you know, kind of pressures on, you know, we want to get people back out. We want to get people into permanent housing. We want to do that. And kind of trying to get people on a very quick timeline, figuring out housing, figuring out childcare, figuring out finances, figuring all of these things out. And so I think it really, really forced us, a part of the you know, the kind of the big picture that we've learned from our work is we really need to think about how we're providing services differently and think about how we're accommodating some of these unique needs. And maybe the best thing for a survivor to do if they come into shelter is to sleep for 16 hours.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they don't want to meet with us. And that doesn't mean they're not interested in figuring out housing.
Rachel and Eve, stand by here for just a second. A lot more to talk about how this can be improved. So we'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about what could be a hidden epidemic of traumatic brain injury among survivors of domestic violence in this country. I'm joined today by Rachel Ramirez. She's with us from Columbus, Ohio. She's a licensed social worker and founder and director of the Center on Partner-Inflicted Brain Injury, a project run by the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. And Eve Valera is with us as well, associate professor at Harvard Medical School and a neuroscientist who spent a couple of decades researching the prevalence of TBI and amongst intimate partner violence survivors. And, you know, a minute or two ago, I had said, hey, maybe if anyone from the NFL wants to use their megaphone to shine a light on this, well, we got a very notable comment on Twitter from Abe Levine, who told me, it should be noted that the NFL has a domestic abuse problem and should be shining a light on how partners of, quote, modern gladiators might also be part of this traumatic brain injury epidemic. But this, of course, would force the NFL and Americans to ask larger questions. So, Abe, point well taken. Now, I want to go back, if we can, and listen to more of the story from Freya Doe. We heard from her at the beginning of the show, and the truly awful abuse she suffered in her first marriage. She told us about her husband smashing her head repeatedly against the wall, throwing her off a porch, hospitalizing her. Her brain was damaged. She had trouble reading, remembering names, and even what she was saying sometimes mid-sentence. And all of those problems she was having, well, she eventually discovered their root cause.
I don't think I ever put two and two together until when I saw the article that Dr. Valera had written, and I was reading it, and I'm looking at all of these symptoms from traumatic brain injury, from domestic violence, and I'm like, got that, been dealing with that. Oh my God, I need to talk to this woman. So it had been almost 30 years since I had had the traumatic brain injury, or, you know, one of my traumatic brain injuries. But it was 15 years when I started noticing symptoms. But I didn't know what those symptoms were related to. And it wasn't until I spoke with Dr. Valera in 2016, 2017, when I finally had answers. And having an answer to what was going on with me was such a relief. And it also allowed me to realize that what happened to me was not a shameful thing. The shame did not belong on me. The shame belonged on him. I know now that sometimes what happens to me is neurofatigue. So if I'm working an 8-hour day, by the end of that day, I try not doing anything that's too brainy, so to speak, because I know I could possibly make a mistake, because by that time of the day, I'm getting neurofatigued. And when I get neurofatigued, I start stuttering. I have many times had to say to people now, I apologize, but my weekend is super busy doing X, Y, or Z, so I can't do this other activity. Can we do it another weekend? Or, you know, I have to limit myself for the things that I can do beyond going to work, which kind of stinks, but but it is what it is, and it's what I have to do in order to keep symptoms at bay. And I told her at that time that, you know, the reason I reached out to her was I didn't think that there was anything that might ever be able to be done for me to help fix me. But if my story, if what happened to me, if my brain, if studying something with me would help someone in the future not have to ever have that question of, am I, you know, having early onset Alzheimer's or some kind of dementia, or am I losing my mind? If I could in any way contribute to her studies and help anybody in the future either not have to deal with that or to help them get answers sooner so that maybe, you know, I could help them discovering ways of helping to reverse these things. Whatever it is that I could do, I wanted to volunteer to do. That's why I donated my brain to the VA Brain Bank. They can't have it now. They have to wait till I'm dead. that's why I volunteered for anything that I could do, including, you know, speaking at these medical symposiums, because I wasn't somebody that got help within a few days or a week or a month or even a year of the brain injury. As being somebody who it's been 30 years and I've really had no medical intervention for rehabilitation, I wanted to do what I could for anyone else down the line. I have the most wonderful husband in the world. When I told him about everything that had happened to me, he just reached over and held me, and he cried for me. And he just said to me, "How could anybody do that to you?" And I said, "I don't know, but they did." He is a very dedicated, loving, tender, sweet human being. And he has been there for me through so many things in the last, we've been together for, God, how long have we been together for? 16 years? Yeah, 16 or 17. However long ago 2006 was. And we've been through so many things. And every day, I'm happy. There isn't a day that goes by that, you know, there's not a hug and a kiss. There's always I love yous. I have the American dream, unfortunately, without the children. But I got the house and the white picket fence and the husband and the dog and 6 chickens. I got a good job, good friends. I have a loving family. And, you know, nothing in life is perfect, but life is pretty darn good.
Freya Doe. And again, we are not using her real name. Freya is a pseudonym in order to protect her safety. Rachel and Eve, and Rachel, I'll start with you first. There's so much that Freya said that we should talk about, but it really just stopped me in my tracks when she said learning about the fact that she had a traumatic brain injury helped her feel less ashamed, and that it allowed her to begin to understand that the shame belonged to her former husband. How important is that? Because I imagine, especially when perhaps there's, you know, children in the picture, and as a survivor, like, you're having trouble seeing, you're having trouble concentrating, your head hurts, all of these things which make it even harder to function in an already impossible environment. The shame must be crippling. So how important is it to if this is a means by which to help women realize it's not their fault?
Yeah. Well, and I will tell you, one of the most powerful things of this whole project is hearing domestic violence victims say, you know, I thought I was stupid. I thought I was crazy. I thought it was me. I didn't know if this stuff was real. But for there to be that knowledge that some of the things that you might be struggling with are impacted by injury. It's not because you're stupid. It's not because something's wrong with you. And also that there are ways in which, when we think about, we can accommodate for those needs. Freya talked about how having knowledge and really recognizing that she's neurofatigued at the end of the day. And she arranges her days differently and doesn't think that when she comes home from work and her brain's really tired and she can't do all of the other tasks, that it's me and I should be able to do this. And I used to be able to do this stuff and now I can't. So it must be something wrong with me. So that has been a huge load off of survivors. And we really think it does help prevent worsening mental health. It does help prevent worsening health problems. It does help prevent even things. I've talked to survivors who have been suicidal because they have all of these things going on and they keep going to these doctors and all of those different kinds of things. So I think that that's another, it has been so amazing for survivors to better understand how they've been impacted and then think about there might be ways in which they can live their lives differently. And also to have that knowledge to be able to make their own decisions about their daily activities and how they do things.
Mm. So, Eve, let me turn to you, because we keep saying there may be an epidemic out there. And I have to put that qualifier on there because we don't, as you said at the beginning of the show, we don't firmly know. And we don't know because there hasn't been enough research yet. Now, Senator Catherine Cortez Masto from Nevada actually authored spearheaded some legislation to get the General Accounting Office to take a look at what HHS, Health and Human Services, is doing regarding, like, are they doing a better job at finding the data or collecting the data about traumatic brain injury and domestic violence. And the GAO in 2020 found that HHS is not doing enough right now. We reached out to Senator Cortez Masto's office to ask about this, and they said the senator's working with HHS and the GAO on next steps to be sure that Health and Human Services can collect this important data. So what needs to happen to get that done, Eve?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, to start, we need more funding. So we absolutely need funding in every category of understanding this issue. So first, for research. So for example, like when we talk about NIH grants, when I tried to get my grant, one of the comments was, this has been done before, because it had been done in male athletes or had been done in servicemen and women. And that is one of the most ridiculous comments ever, but nonetheless, that delayed me getting the funding because of a reviewer with a comment like that. So basically, NIH and the powers that be, research funders, need to recognize that this is different. We need funding to study women, and not just women who have experienced brain injuries, but women who have experienced partner violence that may also include things like strangulation that may result in an interaction between acquired brain injuries from strangulation and traumatic brain injuries from traumas directly to the head. And so money is key here. And so the research will help us understand, well, epidemiological research would be great because then we can know the actual numbers. But then it will help us understand a little more specifically about what's going on. I mean, my data have shown connections between brain injuries and women's ability to learn a list of words, to remember that list of words, to do tasks, you know, cognitive flexibility tasks, and in higher rate, basically it's associated, more brain injuries are associated with having greater levels of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic symptomatology. And strangulation is related to, independent of the other types of brain injuries, is related to working memory and long-term memory and depression as well. So, but there are very, very, very few data out there that like this. And I've sort of done this sometimes on shoestring budgets. My imaging data were basically from a Center of Excellence grant from Harvard. And that was $30,000. And I produced two imaging studies out of that, which is almost miraculous because usually it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to do imaging studies. And so that's really where we need to start for research.
Right.
And then, you know, money for shelters and education, et cetera.
Well, can I just jump
in? I think that's really the bottom line.
Well, so you're saying that awareness amongst even the research community that this is worthy of funding, that seems quite important. Rachel, I'm going to turn back to you in a second. We're running out of time, though, and I should have done this much earlier. But Eve, there may be people listening to this right now who are saying, I know someone that has gone through this or this has happened to me. Where could they go right now for help or more information?
Well, this is Rachel.
Yeah,
go ahead,
Rachel.
And
please.
Take that one.
Yep.
I know that's something, first of all, I mean, we know one of the things I spent my career doing, training and education. So that training, education, and awareness is such an important next step. But I think that, you know, it's important, people out there, you are not alone. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available. You can go to thehotline.org for information about, they have web chat, they have texting, they have a hotline number. There also there are several resources that have been listed, you know, on your website around this show. But we also have at the Ohio Domestic Violence Network, if you go to odvn.org, our Center on Partner Inflicted Brain Injury, there are resources and information that are developed and designed for domestic violence survivors who have experienced brain injury to better understand what it looks like. What are some of those symptoms? What are some of those things you might be noticing about yourself, or some of those signs that you might be noticing about somebody you know who might be different? I think the other thing to remember is that everybody who's listening plays a key role in addressing brain injury caused by violence and addressing domestic violence in general. A very, very, very small percentage of domestic violence victims actually reach out to domestic violence service providers. They talk to their friends. They talk to their families. They talk to their work colleagues. They talk to people they know and trust. So you, by being educated about this, and, you know, one of the reasons that we don't have data or we know so little about this is we've never asked those questions or provided that education, and asked questions like, you know, thank you so much for sharing about your experience. I'm here to support you. Have you ever been hit or hurt in the head? You know, do you know if you get hit or hurt in the head, it can have all of these different symptoms that we've talked about that aren't necessarily obvious, that might not happen right away. And here's some information about that.
Yeah.
So having an educated general public, I always say, now when I provide trainings about domestic violence and I ask people, what does domestic violence look like? People know it's more than physical violence. They know it's emotional abuse. They know it's financial abuse. But also for the general public to know that domestic violence can also cause a brain injury is really, really important.
Well, Rachel Ramirez, licensed social worker and founder director of the Center on Partner-Inflicted Brain Injury, run by the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. Rachel, thank you so very much for coming on the show today.
We cannot thank you enough for providing us with this opportunity.
And Eve Valera, associate professor at Harvard Medical School and research scientist at Massachusetts General Hospital, same to you. Thank you so very much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This is On Point.